Back again with St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Missouri voters will be deciding four constitutional amendment proposals on the November 4th ballot. They will deal with prosecuting sex crimes, early voting, teacher tenure, and to place certain restrictions on the governor's budget prerogatives. St. Louis Public Radio Statehouse reporter Marshall Griffin joins us from Jefferson City. Our education reporter Tim Lloyd is with us in studio. Marshall, good to have you with us.
Thank you. Good to be here.
I don't hear Marshall. Marshall, are you there?
Can you hear me?
There we go. There we go. Good to have you with us.
Good to be here.
Tim, welcome back to the studio.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Let's start with you, Tim, and with Amendment 3, that is the teacher tenure proposal. Tell us what that's all about.
Sure. So Amendment 3 would add three subsections to the Constitution that would change the way teachers are evaluated and retained in the state of Missouri. So it would require teachers be dismissed, retained, demoted, promoted, and paid primarily using what it calls quantifiable student performance data. It would also limit the number of years a school district could offer a contract to a teacher. It could be no more than 3 years. And it would prohibit teachers from organizing or collectively bargaining regarding the design and implementation of the teacher evaluation system. So those are the big changes it would make.
Marshall, there's a political backstory to this, isn't there?
Yes, the teacher tenure has been a legislative agenda of a number of Republican lawmakers, most notably former state senator Jane Cunningham. She was a strong proponent of teacher tenure. It kept coming up short in the legislature, but eventually this version of it got through both chambers and made it onto the ballot this year. And the interesting part of it is that the financial backers have suspended their campaign, so there's no more formal push to try to get this elected. But the opponents still think that it's got a strong shot of might actually get elected in spite of the fact that there's no strong push on the TV airwaves for it right now.
Tim Lloyd, that's almost counterintuitive. In fact, it is counterintuitive, is it not? What's the tactic here?
Essentially, what sort of has been discussed is that while the groups against this amendment, Protect Our Local Schools, which is a large coalition of teachers union, as well as some unexpected groups like PROMO, which advocates for LGBT rights in Missouri, that have come out really strongly against this amendment and have said that they're just focused on defeating this amendment this election cycle. But, you know, many observers have said that perhaps the concern is that this is softening the ground for this to come up again, limits on teacher tenure or more of an emphasis on student testing data. And I talked with University of Missouri St. Louis political science professor Dave Robertson, and he had mentioned that perhaps the ripples of what happens this election cycle will extend out into the future. Here's what he told me.
If there's a big turnout and a big vote against this amendment, it may make Missouri state legislatures more cautious about introducing smaller, more incremental versions of this reform through the state legislature.
So again, there could be much more at stake here than just what happens on November 4th.
You know, Marshall, I think a lot of people are wondering if this is something that deserves a constitutional amendment.
There's always that question. Even some nominal supporters of reforming the current teacher tenure system speak cautiously about whether this is something that needs to be ingrained in the Constitution, opting for possibly trying to campaign for the idea itself in hopes that it can just be put into statute at some point. But so far that approach hasn't worked. So now we have this.
Isn't there a Rex Singfield component to this story as well? He, of course, is the billionaire who spends a lot of money trying to influence politics in this state.
Absolutely. So Teach Great, which was the group that had really been in support of this amendment, had gathered more than 275,000 signatures to get it on the ballot in November, abruptly basically folded in early September. And Rex Singfield had spent close to $1.6 million in support of that group, and just like that, they were out of it and pulled up. They got rid of their website, and that's it.
Marshall, he's everywhere.
Well, he's everywhere, but at Amendment 3 at the moment. So.
Right.
You look for this to come back in some form next session?
I think it will. I mean, there will at least be a couple of versions of this filed, and I think until it actually happens, I think the proponents will continue to file every year. Unless support of just evaporates, you know, drastically for it. But at this point, I think the proponents will continue to file every year until they get something, as long as they feel like they've got a shot.
Tim, you spend a lot of time with teachers, given your beat is education. They feel like they're being batted around with this?
Sure. I mean, any number of teachers' unions, have come out and said this is not what we want. They say, listen, in fact, we can lose our jobs. It just simply having tenure means that district or a school board would have to go through a due process to take away our jobs, but we can lose our jobs. And ultimately, there's hesitation anytime you bring up student data. It doesn't say student or standardized testing in the language or in the ballot language for this, but most teachers say, give me a break. You know, we know what student data means. That means more testing. We already have a lot of testing. We don't want more testing, and we don't want to feel like we don't have a security in our job.
Marshall, there are a lot of teachers out there. It would be a tough group, I would think, to mess with politically because there are so many.
Yes, and their union is strong and very motivated.
Anything else we want to say about Amendment 3 before we move on to some of the other propositions, Tim?
Well, I think it is important to note that teacher evaluations in Missouri are already getting an overhaul this year. They have to come in line with 7 principles that the Missouri Department of Elementary and Secondary Education have set out for districts. And one of those standards is student data. It does have to be quantifiable. It just simply doesn't state how much of a role student data needs to play in teachers' evaluations. This amendment would say that it has to be primarily based on student data.
Right. Marshall, any thoughts that you might have to wrap this part of it up with?
I think the vote might be close, whichever way it goes. I think it will probably still be a fairly close vote, but that's just my opinion.
Even though one group has basically suspended the campaign?
Yes.
And I can tell you that the campaign against this amendment brings that up. They say, listen, when Teach Great was out collecting signatures, they talked to a lot of Missourians about this amendment, and they aren't taking this for granted at all.
All right. Well, that will be Amendment 3 on the ballot, of course, on November 4th, which would base teacher tenure in K-12 schools on student performance instead of seniority. Tim, thank you for being with us. Feel free to stay if you'd like and hear the rest of what we have to say, Marshall and I. Marshall, I'd like to move along to Amendment 2, which basically deals with prosecuting sex crimes against children primarily, including evidence of prior criminal acts admissible in sex crime cases if the victim is under the age of 18. What else can you tell me about that one?
Well, this basically came out of a Supreme Court decision way back in 2007, State versus Ellison. Back at that time, propensity evidence was allowed to be used in certain cases if the victim was, I believe, under the age of 14. And based on the Supreme Court decision, it tossed out the use of propensatory evidence, pardon me there, basically saying that it violated the Missouri Constitution's guarantee that a defendant will only be tried for the crime with which he is charged, and that standard remains in place today. And a lot of children's advocates and prosecutors have said that this makes it easier for sex offenders to get away with committing crimes. What they want to do is put into the Constitution specifically that would allow the use of propensity evidence in certain cases, when the defendant is charged with a sex crime against someone younger than 18 years old. It would include evidence of past criminal sexual activity in cases where the defendant was not convicted, or in some cases not even charged with a crime, but just arrested but not formally charged. Those would be allowed to be brought into the trial phase. At the moment, propensity evidence is allowed during the sentencing phase only. This would allow it in the trial phase in these specific cases.
Is there any particular case that brought this to the fore that caused our legislature to want to put this on the ballot?
No specific case that I'm aware of at the moment, but I will tell you that the campaign to get it into the state constitution began the year after the 2007 ruling. The former state senator John Loudon was the first to to file such legislation, and they've been pushing for it ever since, and it finally made it onto the ballot in the form of H.J.R. 16.
And the American Civil Liberties Union is not at all happy with what they see on in Amendment 2.
No, they are not. They released a statement basically saying that we should only be tried only on the crime charged. Missourians should avoid the temptation to allow evidence of uncharged crimes to be presented at trial simply to demonstrate a propensity or tendency to commit a crime. That's from the ACLU's statement. Another group that's against it is the Missouri Association of Criminal Defense Attorneys. They're also strongly against this and are taking an official stand against it.
Is this another one of those votes when this was before the legislature, Marshall, that was pretty much along party lines?
I will confess that I have not followed the legislation for this one that closely, but I do tend to remember that there was bipartisan support for this from both parties. How strong that bipartisan support was, I'd have to go back and look.
Okay, well, as long as you have bipartisan support for it, that's all we really need to know at this particular juncture. Anything else we need to say about that?
At this point, my guess is that it will pass just from the looks of it. A lot of people, if they just read the basics of the ballot, will probably think it's a good idea and vote to pass it. So I don't see this going down in defeat.
Okay, well, we'll wait for November 4th to get the final word on that. Let's move on to Amendment 6 now. This is the early voting amendment. I'll leave it to you, Marshall, to explain what that's all about, and then we'll talk further about it.
Okay, well, both political parties have said that they want early voting and that early voting is a good thing and will expand democracy to more people and enable more people to get to the polls. Where the opinion divides is what form of early voting should there be? During the legislative session, there was this particular one that we're going to be voting on called H.J.R. 90 was the one that prevailed. It was backed by Republican majority in the House, and what it would do was it would create a 6 days of early voting that would begin the Wednesday that's 2 weeks before Election Day, run Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, and then the following Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, the week before Election Day. So those 6 days would be the early voting period. It would only be during regular business hours, so 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. or maybe 5:30, you know, just depending, I suppose, on we'll have to get the fine-tune that, but it's during regular business hours, roughly 8 to 5. No early evening voting, no early morning voting, no weekend voting. That's where the different split. The House Democrats and also Secretary of State Jason Kander strongly opposed to this version. They wanted a citizens-backed initiative that did not make it onto the ballot. The citizens' initiative would have created a six-week early voting period that would have included Saturdays and Sundays and would have also included early evening hours, roughly till 7 p.m. Or 6:30 p.m., somewhere in that that neighborhood. So you had a battle there between those two versions, and the legislative version that the Republicans wanted was the one that made it onto the ballot.
You know, you have to think, and this is just my opinion, I won't ask you to express an opinion, but that if they had worked any harder to try to make this confusing, they probably couldn't have made it more so.
Well, it simply came down to one argument saying you're limiting access. The people who are most likely to vote after hours and on the weekends are the ones who would not have voted you into office. You know, that's the argument of the Democrats. And the argument of the Republicans is that having Saturday and Sunday early voting hours for a six-week period is just too much of a financial burden on counties and local governments. This particular ballot initiative, House Joint Resolution 90, that is now Amendment 6, that version would have the state covering the cost of early voting. But it would have to be renewed every year. The governor and the legislature would have to, every year, sign off on funding the early voting period of 6 days.
Yeah, it almost seems as if this has been structured, designed to fail. And my guess is that the people who put this together want it to be voted down.
Yeah, well that's an interesting question, interesting point, because even if this does pass, and frankly, I think it's got a good chance of passing. Who wouldn't want to vote early if they had the chance? Even if this becomes part of the Constitution, that doesn't necessarily mean that the Republican-led House and Senate and the Democratic governor will agree to fund it. And that's something that they would have to do every year. And if they agree not to fund it, then there is no early voting.
So it's not a question of having your Constitution with you when you prepare to vote. You better have your calendar, too, to make sure it's the right day to vote early.
You just might need to, yeah. That would be a good recommendation.
Okay. Well, you know, the thing that strikes me, and again, I have the opportunity to express some opinion here. I wouldn't ask you to, but, you know, weekends are the time when people who don't have time to vote during the week do have time to vote, and weekends are excluded from this.
Yes, they are. And like I say, that goes back to the argument of the Democrats saying that this would specifically target people who, who would normally vote for us, perhaps, versus the Republican argument that state and local municipalities cannot afford to open the polls on the weekends.
All of this to stave off of the potential for a citizen petition, which might have had a much, much different look and probably would have. The League of Women Voters is against that. That's significant.
Yes, they oppose this as well.
Okay, my eyes are beginning to glaze a little bit because I'm looking now at Amendment 10, Marshall. I'm going to leave it to you. Sorry to pass the ball to you on this, but this is fairly complicated. This deals with the governor's budgetary prerogatives. Why don't you tell us what Amendment 10 is all about?
Well, it's all about, and I know we have about 5 minutes left, so I'll try to be brief. Feel free to jump in.
I probably won't.
The ongoing battle between Governor Nixon and the Republican House and Senate. Every year that Governor Nixon has been in office, he has withheld money from the state budget. There's two types of ways to veto budget spending. There's, of course, the official line item veto, which when the governor uses that money is gone. That money is permanently gone from that year's state budget. But he also does something called withholding, which is often referred to as cuts. You'll hear that referred to as a cut in a news report or a newscast. But a withhold is not a permanent cut. It's just you're not releasing the money to that particular state agency. The reason why is because, well, right now revenues are down and we can't afford to do it. But if the revenue picture improves, say, by September, we'll let you have the money in September. So that's basically what a withhold is. This basically would prevent the governor or limit his ability to withhold money. He would only be able to do so if, revenues are truly down. Of course, the governor has said in every case, yes, revenues are truly down. That's why I've needed to do it. Republicans have come back and said, basically, and I'm just paraphrasing here, no, you're doing this because you didn't like, the budget we sent you, or you didn't like this particular policy, or you're mad at us for, overriding your veto on tax cuts, and you're punishing us. So that's been the back-and-forth argument between the Democratic governor and the Republican House and Senate pretty much since 2009, but especially more so, more heated, since the governor was reelected.
This is pure politics at work.
Absolutely. It is. And one interesting thing is I was looking at this bill and writing up a story for it, is that if the and I'm going to just read you a little quote here from the bill. The governor would have to issue a proclamation to the House or Senate whenever he reduces appropriations as a result of actual revenues being less than the revenue estimates. Then the House or Senate, depending on which chamber a spending item came from, originated in, would then have the authority to override that spending cut or that withhold. They could do so at any time that the General Assembly is in session.
Ouch. Well, we'll leave it to our listeners to sort that out. It will be explained on the ballot on November 4th. Marshall Griffin, I want to thank you so much for being with us, along with Tim Lloyd, to help us understand a little bit better what we'll be voting on the 4th of November. Thank you.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk with Julius Hunter about his new historical novel based on 6 years of research on two former slave women who made a fortune running brothels in Victorian St. Louis. Archived versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you for listening. I'm Don Marsh.